Welcome to DAD, Dads Aren't Deadbeats, a community of care and compassion in observance of the Golden Rule. Come and join us and contribute to riveting conversations about fathers, their children, rights and agency.
It's Monday.
It's National Carpe Diem Day. This episode is sponsored by Sensibility, Logic and Reason. Because, well, without this, we're just banging around in the dark.
And you are very welcome to the DAD podcast. So Carpe Diem, that's Latin, right, Matt?
It certainly is, buddy. It roughly translates to seize the day. And we're certainly doing that on the Dad podcast. Tiny audience, big vision, and an expansion plan. Carpe Diem.
Yay. So let's jump in with the public disclaimer and trigger warning. You do one and I do the other?
Yeah, I'm good with that.
So, again, we're just two blokes. We sat in a shed, drinking tea and vaping away. We are not now and have never been legal experts. The information you are about to hear has, though, been thoroughly researched, and we always aim to bring you the most accurate information possible.
We're going to talk about a rather controversial topic on the show today, non-molestation orders. We will be as objective as possible in this process, but if you're likely to be offended, perhaps skip this one.
So here's another thing that gets the big man animated, listener land. What's your issue with people being offended, dude?
Well, essentially, I've got no problem at all with people being offended. I've got an issue with people telling me that something is offensive. I'm much more comfortable if somebody says that offended me. That makes perfect sense. You can say you can hear a joke and say that offended me. It doesn't make the joke offensive. And it's the same with topics.
So you're happy for people to have their own opinions, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm okay with people being offended. It's perfectly acceptable to be offended, but it doesn't mean, one, that the thing the person was telling you was said to offend you, and two, it doesn't mean that you're justified in feeling offended. It's not quite the same thing.
He's getting animated already.
I certainly am. So, before we begin, folks, non-molestation orders can be sought by men, women alike, and non-binary others too. They are basically court injunctions, and we'll talk more about these in a little while. So as you know, we're not about misogyny on this platform, and so whilst we are discussing sensitive and difficult subjects, we're doing so with kindness and observance of the Golden Rule. We at Dad ardently oppose domestic violence of any kind. If you're the sort of man, woman, or non-binary other who abuses others, as we've said many times before, this is not the platform for you, and you probably deserve to be buried underneath the prison.
Yeah, so if you're offended in any way by this episode, that's okay. Being offended at least means we're applying our critical thinking skills to think about tough topics, which is necessary if we are invested in truth.
Nicely put that, man. There is nothing wrong with feeling offended, but there is such a thing as justifiable offence. If I said something vicious and threatening towards you, Lee, right now, you'd be justified in feeling offended, but if I said something we just fundamentally disagreed on, that offence might be misplaced. So let's get into this. Shall we have a look at the history of non-molestation orders first?
Yeah, we can do. Let's use the abbreviation from this point forwards, though, shall we? And you know what the abbreviation is? Non-moles.
Non-moles is good with me.
So last week, a segment of the show was given over to discussing the legal aid system. In contemporary UK family law, the legal aid and non-molestation injunctions are interlinked. So let's get into it, Matt. What is a non-molestation order?
Okay, so in the United Kingdom, non-molestation orders are powerful legal tools designed to protect individuals from violence, harassment, and intimidation. They serve as a crucial mechanism for safeguarding victims of domestic abuse and for preventing further harm. They're a court injunction and usually include certain restrictions and limitations. In this podcast, we will investigate these important court injunctions, we'll explore the history of domestic abuse, and we'll identify how all is not as it seems in the non-molestation process due to it being, how would we describe it, an uncomfortable bedfellow of the legal aid system, perhaps. So Lee, should we do a bit of history around domestic violence and legislation to put this into context?
Let's do it. The patriarchal nature of the 1800s made domestic violence a normality and shaped attitudes and behaviours towards women. Women suffered disproportionately as a result of social structure that treated domestic abuse as a private matter within an individual household. The law allows husbands to exercise authority over their wives, again, I'm in shock just by saying that out loud, Matt. It's crazy. According to Black, 2019, the rule of thumb was a legal doctrine that permitted men to physically discipline their wives and children, establishing and reinforcing the power dynamics in the marriage. So, Matt, why was this type of behaviour accepted in the 1800s? Because I think everyone in Listen Land knows that that behaviour, whether it was 100 or 200 years ago, should not have been allowed.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that, because it should never have been allowed. You're right, absolutely. It shouldn't have been allowed. But part of the reason it was that in 1800s in Britain, most people described themselves as belonging to the Christian faith. It was around about 80% of the population at that time. So according to Bebbington in 2015, religion played a huge role in family life, with biblical teachings frequently utilised to reinforce patriarchal norms. So, for example, a passage from Timothy 2:12 says, "I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man." Completely ridiculous idea, but one that would have been used to reinforce this patriarchal stereotype. And another from Timothy, "He must manage his household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive." And this highlights that perceived authority of men over women. I think what's important here is that we recognise that, right? It's a perception of authority. The authority was never really there. Men were just perceived to have it. So the Matrimonial Clauses Act of 1857 was the first piece of legislative reform that allowed women the right to seek divorce, although a woman's reasons for doing so were extremely limited and centred on the religious disdain for adulterous behaviour.
So the 1800s, they sound absolutely horrific.
Yeah, they absolutely were. But at least religion does not have the same stranglehold in the modern day. So what's the contemporary legislative framework around domestic violence and non-molestation orders?
Domestic violence is covered through several pieces of contemporary legislation. It mainly sits within the Family Law Act of 1996, which was the Act of Parliament that introduced non-molestation orders as a specific legal remedy for victims of domestic abuse. Part 4 of the Act, Family Homes and Domestic Violence, outlines the provisions related to non-molestation orders. There are 4 aspects to this. Shall we cover 2 each?
Yeah, sure, why not? So, definitions of molestation. The Act defines molestation, and I'm doing the bunny ears here, listener land. I know you can't see us, but nevertheless, it broadly describes molestation as a range of behaviours including violence, harassment, intimidation, and threats.
The second aspect is the granting of the non-molestation orders. Section 42 of the Act empowers the court to grant non-molestation orders to protect individuals from molestation or the threat of molestation by a person.
Duration and variation of orders makes up the third aspect of this injunction, or this injunction process. Non-mols can be granted for a specified period, typically up to 1 year, but the court has the discretion to vary the duration based upon the individual circumstances of the case.
The final aspect of this element of the Act is directives on the breach of orders. The Act addressed the consequences of breaching non-molestation orders. It outlines the rights of courts to imprison individuals who break these orders and or fine regime to doing so.
Absolutely. And and I think we'd all agree that if somebody is being domestically abusive, so I grew up in a household where there was domestic abuse, you should be in prison for breaching an order like this.
You should be. You shouldn't be allowed to walk the streets if you're that type of person.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
But going back to, obviously, what you said about non-molestation orders being active for 12 months, the length of them is normally between 6 and 12 months. So you were right on that. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And as we can see, that might be problematic depending on how that non-molestation orders being requested, but we'll get to that. So in addition to the Family Law Act of 1996, the Family Procedural Rules, or FPR for short, provide procedural guidelines for family law cases, which includes applications for non-molestation orders. Part 19 of the FPR deals specifically with injunctions and restraining orders. This part outlines the procedural requirements for making applications, serving documents, and conducting hearings relating to non-molestation orders.
Now, another Act of Parliament, the Domestic Crime and Victims Act 2004, introduced amendments to the Family Law Act 1996 to strengthen the legal frameworks for protecting victims of domestic abuse. Key provisions of this act include emergency protection. This act introduced emergency protection orders to provide immediate protection to victims of domestic violence in emergency situations. These orders can be granted by a magistrate's court. It also made provisions for the breach of orders. This meant the Act increased penalties for breaching non-mols and other protective orders, reflecting the seriousness with which such breaches are treated.
Now, arguably, the most significant Act of Parliament relating to non-mol orders is the Legal Aid Sentencing of Offenders and Punishments Act 2012. LASPO for short. We spoke about this briefly last week, but in relation to non-molestation orders, LASPO introduced significant reforms to the legal aid system in England and Wales, impacting access to legal aid. Now, whilst legal aid was still available to victims of domestic abuse, a much stricter eligibility criteria was introduced.
So, anybody can apply for a non-molestation order if they feel they have been domestically abused. Now, here lies the problem. Domestic abuse is not clearly defined. An argument amongst one couple may be perceived by both parties as nothing more than just a disagreement, but another couple may choose to describe this as domestic abuse.
So yeah, court injunctions usually impose a set of criteria on a respondent. The respondent is the person who has the injunction made against them. They can last 6 to 12 months, although court do have the discretion on varying the times, and the limitations can include zonal restrictions that prevent the respondent from nearing the matrimonial home and, in some cases, their children.
Non-molestation orders are court orders and so usually are served by a process server. Again, we spoke about this in one of our previous podcasts. They were previously known as court bailiffs. The order only comes into effect once it is served to the respondent.
So let's have a little chat about that then. I've had personal encounters with process service in the past.
Okay.
It would be really easy, I think, to lose your head with them, particularly if you know that the reason they're there is spurious at best.
Yeah, to hand you papers as of which you don't know
what they are. Yeah, you have no idea what's coming. Yeah. So this was the incident I was in. I was being served process papers for a perceived sum of money that I owed somebody else. I didn't actually owe that sum of money.
Yeah.
And so the process server turned up, and it would have been really easy to just lose.
Did they turn up at your home?
They turned up at my workplace.
At your workplace?
Right? Yeah, which was uncomfortable, embarrassing. There's evidently going to be questions after the fact, right? Everyone that saw that dude there wanted to know why.
They'll all be saying, oh, look what's going on, man. Yeah.
What's he done now? What's he been up to? You know, that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, it was kind of, I've got two choices. I can give this person who's just doing a job a hard time, or I can deal with the plonker who sent this person around to see me and give them a hard time. I opted for the latter. I wasn't going to rag on this guy.
Yeah.
So do you know that they also wear body-worn cameras?
I do, Matt, I do.
Yeah. So they wear body-worn cameras at all times, process service. And once they do that and they engage with you, that they're creating a public record and you can request that body-worn footage.
So you can FOIA that footage.
Absolutely, yeah. Or subject request it, yeah. And the issue with that is that it can kind of go either in your favour, if you were a good boy like me and didn't get into it with the process server, but it can go against you too. I mean, I want you to imagine it that you're... Let's imagine you're a person who's been served papers and they're non-molestation orders because you beat the crap out of somebody yesterday, for argument's sake. And then instead of being polite to this process server, you decide you're going to try and beat the crap out of him too.
It just proves a point there, doesn't it?
And then you're on camera, right? And the camera just doesn't lie.
Yeah.
If ever you're in a situation, folks, where you're being addressed by a process server, don't give them a hard time. They're just there to do a job, just like anybody else. And they've got no beef with you.
They haven't. They're just there to do their job. They're there to get paid, go home safely. Again, like we just said, they wear CCTV. Well, should I call it CCTV, I say? I'm thinking old school.
Yeah, body-worn cameras.
Yeah, body-worn cameras. So, it's for everyone's protection. And like we said, they're just doing a job. So just stay calm.
Yeah, stay calm.
Don't give lose them a hard your time. Act.
And if you're in the sort of circumstances that we'll speak about briefly in a moment, where you're being served a non-molestation order and you legitimately did nothing wrong, you absolutely shouldn't lose your temper then, because you did nothing wrong in the first place.
No, you shouldn't.
You don't add to this person's false claim by then, you know, kicking off at the process server.
Yeah, but I imagine for a lot of people it would be a shock, just some random individual turning up to, again, your place of work, where you live, to give you papers, and you're like, what the... I was going to swear then, folks, but I'm not going to.
Well, Ryan Deeming won't need that explicit label.
Yeah, but you know, what is going on?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're bewildered with what's in front of you.
It just blows you away. It's, okay. Well, let's carry on.
So to apply for a non-molestation order, an FL401 form needs to be completed, and this is available from the government website. The form is over 20 pages long and also requires supporting documents and evidence. Therefore, non-molestation orders can be applied for by anybody, but we would recommend seeking legal advice to fill these forms in.
Yeah, absolutely. If nothing else, I'd kind of argue for having support in filling the form in, because ideally, and in the interest of transparency, you should only have to submit that form once.
Yes, you should, yes.
So if you've been domestically abused, the facts of that abuse will be in evidence.
Yes. By evidence, witness statements.
Well, further than that, really. So yeah. I was thinking about when I was a child. I'm happy to announce this to Visitor Land, because anybody that knows me knows I talk about this openly. I had my own dad beat the living daylights out of me when I was a kid, and I broke two ribs and broke a nose. And that evening, I was at the hospital being photographed. So there's evidence for that. That process. So yeah, you'd expect there to be some sort of evidence associated with it, and seek legal help, because you should only have to fill that form in once.
Yeah,
this is where I think part of the process goes a little bit awry for me. So it's the fact that you can, in theory, you can fill in a non-molestation order multiple times.
Yeah.
So it also almost becomes a case of being able to say, "This is my claim."
Yeah.
And then a judge sees it and says, that claim isn't nearly strong enough, or there isn't evidence that supports that claim.
Yeah.
And then you can go away and rewrite it.
And then go back to the same judge or a different judge?
You can go either to the same judge or a different one, but the point is just that you get a do-over is problematic.
So what you're saying is you get to rewrite everything that you made in your original claim to gain a non-molestation order until you have one.
Essentially, that can happen, and that's what bothers me with this system, is that you can go away and rewrite the thing multiple times.
So, for example, if I wanted to make a claim now that you had beat the living hell out of me, I could write it all down and get a non-molestation order against you, even though it's just a claim.
You could, in theory, do that, yeah. I think with acts like physical violence, it's a little more difficult to get away with, because the standard of evidence... You'd expect to see something that went beyond just a witness statement, right? You'd expect to see some sort of
pictures,
bruising,
and
broken ribs. Yeah. Right? You'd expect to
police
see something.
Police reports.
But there are other forms of domestic violence where you wouldn't necessarily have that kind of evidence. But it just, the do-over process bothers me, because it does mean that you get to go away and rethink what your original claim was. And this is where the problem lies. Multiple attempts encourages an exaggeration of the facts, because the application is often tied to being granted legal aid. So if as a person you make a false accusation, for example, a false claim, and you go and you know that your plan is that you want to divorce your partner as favourably as you can to you. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm down with that. That's exactly what everybody that gets divorced...
You sounded proper cool then when you said, I'm down with that.
I tried, you know, and it's Friday, so, you know, so I get that you want it to end favourably for you, but at the end of the day, that being able to do over is problematic, because it means you get to go away and exaggerate those facts if the original claim doesn't allow you to be granted legal aid. That's hugely problematic. We don't ever stand that for anything else in the legal system. There's no other circumstances in which you get to go and report something to the police, and when they didn't believe you the first time, you get to go back and re-report it.
It's crazy.
It's just not how it goes. It's ludicrous.
It's crazy.
It makes a mockery out of things, really. Right, so I'm conflicted on this next point, Lee, and think we might have to wrestle with it a bit. Non-molestation orders can be applied for without the respondent being told about the application. This is known as a without notice or ex parte application. These are particularly useful when somebody needs protection urgently, and I'm really pleased that legislation changed to allow that rapid support of people who were in difficult circumstances and they could get emergency protections. That's good. But the order isn't finalised when it's first made. This is another thing that bears warrant in stressing. If you're issued papers by a process server, it then has to go to court. There has to be a fact-finding hearing in the court. And the court needs to hear from both sides before granting the order. The issue, though, and some interesting discussion points might be around that idea of ex parte applications.
Yeah, I think obviously not knowing you're going to receive a non-molestation is a shock. And I think you've got 14 days to respond to the paperwork whenever you do receive it, whether or not you want to obviously fight this order, you've deemed it to be wrong, or if you agree with it, just to accept it. But I think what I've found with a lot of people, because I've spoken to a lot of people this year that have had non-molestation orders, Matt, I'll be brutally honest with everybody in Listenerland, to fight a non-molestation order, whether you are innocent or not, it costs you thousands of pounds. Yeah. And I think we spoke about finances last week and what to expect. But to actually fight something that you know, for example, if you did and you do choose to fight it, then that's on your head. But if you know you didn't something, you are 9 out of 10, you are going to want to obviously say, well, I don't deserve this.
Yeah, because that sense of social justice we have. Yeah.
But again, that's where it will hit you financially to fight that. And again, seek obviously legal advice.
So I think one of the biggest issues is this idea of ex parte applications. Now, ex parte applications are an excellent idea because it means that your abuser doesn't get to sit in front of you whilst you're effectively making an application against them, that they can be kept in the dark about it. And that's certainly something I'd like to have seen happen when I was a kid. I'd like my dad to have been held to account for some of the things he did.
Yeah.
And ex parte applications for this kind of thing would have been ideal and would have addressed those issues. The issue comes when there is no actual evidence of abuse other than a witness statement.
Yes, but I think by you saying that, I think 25% of these orders do get granted just by witness statements.
They do, yeah, quite disturbingly. And we'll share those stats and our sources with you momentarily. Yeah, a lot of them, an entire quarter, in fact, appear to be granted without the burden of proof
burden
being
of
met.
Proof, yeah.
And it's, you know, we spoke about this in the truth episode, but the burden of proof is vitally important and rests on the shoulders of the accuser.
Yeah.
There's a few misconceptions around our legal system, and I was talking to students about it the other day, that they were saying, you know, when you go into court, you have to prove your innocence. And that simply isn't true, folks, just so we are all on the same page with this. In our legal process, you're not going into court to prove your innocence. The party making an accusation has to prove your guilt.
Yes.
You're just defending against those arguments. So there are long-term implications of labelling individuals as being accused of being abusive. And it does have chronic knock-on effects for some. I had a friend who was the subject of physical abuse. He perpetrated physical abuse. And when I say friend, I'm using that term very loosely, more of an acquaintance, really. He should have been buried under the prison like every other abuser. But I've had other friends who did not abuse somebody, was accused of it, and then was labelled as an abuser for the next several years. I mean, cut out from society, people ignored him and stopped talking to him. It was brutal. He'd done nothing wrong. And the reason I know this was, on the day he was accused of behaving in a way that was abhorrent, he was with me.
Yeah.
So it didn't happen. But
so
anyway.
This is where we obviously discuss the concept of truth. And obviously, if someone's with you and they make a claim, it's
a claim is just that, right? It's
a claim is just a claim until proven.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my concerns relates to people not understanding the criminal implications of a non-mol. I can appreciate how it happens and why, but the destruction of the legal aid system essentially is the key contributor to this. And what it does is, in our humble opinion, it provides an unnecessary incentive to either lie or extend the truth to be able to claim legal aid. Now, we will get into this in a moment, but requesting a non-mol comes with very serious consequences. So can I share an example?
Yeah.
Okay. So in April of last year, a High Court judge, Judge Mrs. Justice Levine, DBE, noted that, here's the bunny ears again, If a without statement application is made, then the statement is in support must expressly deal with why the case is exceptional and what the significant risk alleged is. Now, what this seems to be saying is that if you are presenting a case that's based on witness statement only, you must have
more supporting evidence.
Absolutely. There must be something that warrants granting that in the absence of firm evidence, yeah.
Now, in cases where non-molestation orders are needed for, obviously, for 100% legit reasons, Matt, I think we can both agree on this, it is an amazing system.
It is indeed. And so we're clear to listener land. We're not saying that there shouldn't be, absolutely shouldn't be do-overs. There are going to be some circumstances, some exceptional circumstances, in which it is necessary to refile a non-molestation order. If, for example, you have a learning disability such as dyslexia, you may not file that form correctly or not convey your thinking and ideas as clearly as you might want to. But it should be exceptional, a refiling. In the same way, there's that word again. So there was some interesting language used in the quote I used by the judge a moment ago, and she appears to be saying that it's necessary to demonstrate the exceptional nature of a case in order for that case to come forward without evidence.
Indeed, and that is problematic if you get a second, third, or even fourth run at the application, right?
Absolutely.
Anyway, but that isn't all she said. She went on to comment that, again with the bunny ears, there can be no doubt that far too many such applications are made when there is no reasonable basis to grant the application without notice.
So that's a High Court judge in the UK last year saying this.
Yeah.
So there seems to be this movement towards really looking at just how many of these applications are being made ex parte. And how problematic that is. So probably part of the reason we're kind of suggesting it might be problematic is our entire legal system is built upon the idea of you being able to face your accusers.
Yes.
And being able to stand in your defence against the claim that's made on you.
Yeah.
I think that just in that a High Court judge is recognising this to be a problem, it warrants further sort of investigation. Now, pleasingly, there does seem to be some movement towards reviewing the number of non-molestation orders that have been made, firstly.
Yeah.
And we can tell that in that the legal aid system is currently under review.
Yeah, and I think the increases over the past few years with the stats that we will give later on in the show will obviously prove that.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is genuinely quite disturbing. At the same time, we at DAD would like to see the legal aid system going back to how it was in the 1940s, which is everybody that needs it can access it.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure, before anybody shouts at me and says, well, how is that affordable? I don't know. But what I'm saying is it is probably a better alternative. There is a better alternative than having 25% of claims made where there's no good reason for making them.
Now, again, with a non-molestation order, obviously, we've spoken about the circumstances in which people can get one and why they should get one. Mm-hmm. But obviously, people have different circumstances. For example, you might get one against... You could even get one against a close friend mm-hmm. who you think has done you some sort of abuse. Mm-hmm. If you're in a relationship, if you're in a marriage, you could obviously get one against your partner. So, come on then, big man. So, if you've got a non-mol against your partner and you are living together... Mm-hmm. What would you say the next steps would be in this process?
Yeah, so if invariably you have to abide by the court order regardless. So if that court order places a zonal restriction on you, they often come hand in hand with occupation orders, which we'll talk about in next week's part.
Yes.
But they essentially mean that zonal restriction can mean you're asked to leave your matrimonial home.
Yes.
And that in itself has all sorts of issues relating to it too. Where that's granted reasonably, if you've beat the living crap out of your partner and they take a non-molestation, you shouldn't be in that house.
You absolutely
have no claim to be there whilst that matter's being resolved. But if you did nothing, and it's a hyperbole, it's made up, I think it's horrific and it's dreadful that this happens.
So let's get into the uncomfortable territory of thinking critically about the orders and their potential for misuse. According to the Ministry of Justice, 4,925 non-molestation orders were granted in 2012. This, of course, was the year LASPO was introduced. Again, looking at the Ministry of Justice data between March 2022 and March 23, 30,979 applications were made. Why do you think that is, Matt? Because that is a staggering amount.
It really is an incredible increase. And Lee, I think it's a really complicated question, and so not easy to answer.
I think we can safely say that obviously COVID had, again, we spoke about COVID being a part of this and the rise of two people living in the same home in each other's pockets day in, day out, can't go to work, who's doing this, who's doing that. This is where a lot of marriages do break down.
Absolutely. I think it was difficult for an awful lot of people living in that combined space, in that bubble, as it were. And a lot of people struggled with it. Yeah. A lot of my mates realised they didn't really like the person they'd been married to for 20 years.
That's crazy.
It's disturbing. But yeah, it's a difficult question to answer, though, in all honesty. Why is that the case that we've seen an increase? If we're interested in truth and transparency, we need to present both sides of the argument here. And so we're going to try and present different perspectives. In 2018-19, the number of non-molestation orders issued was 8,839. This was an increase of 18% on the previous year. Now, there are two schools of thought as to why we have witnessed such a monumental increase in these orders being granted. And Lee, would you like to tell us the first of those?
Certainly. There is almost certainly a correlative link between the changes to the legal aid system through LASPO and the increase in non-moles being granted. This, though, has been questioned by the Managing Director of Women's Aid. She contests that the increase of non-mole orders is reflective in changes in society's views towards domestic abuse. She additionally suggests that police are receiving record numbers of domestic abuse claims, and in these circumstances, we would expect to see an increase in applications for these orders. This point is hotly contested, though, Matt.
It is indeed, yeah. In 2018, Jerry Carlin, who's the chair of the charitable organisation Fathers Need Families, argued that there was evidence to suggest that people were exaggerating or making what he described as bogus allegations against former partners to secure legal aid. Now, as we've said already, we don't want to use language that's quite as defamatory as that. I wouldn't necessarily call a claim to get legal aid bogus, for the sole purpose of getting legal aid.
Yeah.
I think that says more about the system being broken than it does the choices somebody has to make to access what they feel they're entitled to.
Yeah.
It's a separate argument whether or not they are entitled to it, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a completely separate argument. But it's worrying. Now, in The Guardian, an article they published in 2018 saw Jerry use some really highly emotive language, and he suggested that the courts, here's the bunny ears again, were being weaponized by angry and vengeful parents. Now, in the same article, he goes on to say something which is frankly ridiculous. He suggests that there should be checks and balances put in place to ensure non-moles are not a weaponization of the family court process. What are your thoughts on that? Checks and balances to make sure non-moles aren't weaponised.
100%, they should be. They shouldn't be weaponised to obviously get one over on the other party. To, in my opinion, like we just said there with Jerry's statement that he made to secure legal aid. Mm-hmm. Now I think as we've said, legal aid is an amazing tool to have for obviously people.
Agreed.
To use. It's not there to be weaponised. It's there to be aided. Mm-hmm. It's there to aid people. But I think the correlative reasons for legal aid and non-molestation orders has significantly become a question.
Oh yeah, there's a correlation between the two without a doubt. My hang-up with what Jerry said here is that there should be checks and balances, and I couldn't even tell you what that would look like. I've no idea how that would work.
So for example, let's put a theory out there. Let's say a couple, for example, one issues a non-molestation against the other,
mm-hmm.
Just by a witness statement,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously the person making the claim just writing the statement themselves.
Yeah.
And let's just say they wanted to go down separation or divorce or along them sort of routes.
With you.
Would legal aid still secure the divorce, the financial matters between the parties? With an active non-molestation or without a non-active molestation?
Yeah, so I see what you're saying. Yeah, you'd need... Some people will go for a non-molestation order to get legal aid. I get that. My concern is, what checks and balances do you put in place? So let me give you an example. If you accuse a partner of sexually assaulting you,
yeah,
there may not be physical evidence of the fact that that's happened.
Yes.
That's what we call a non-falsifiable claim.
Yeah.
Because neither party can falsify the other person's claim. The only people who know what's happened are those two people in that space at that given time. So what checks and balances could you have to make sure that that was either an honest claim or a false claim interested in weaponising the legal aid system? You just couldn't do it. So I think Jerry's kind of... I see what he's saying. We know that 25% of these are bogus. Yeah. We know that that's weaponized because the legal aid system is broken horrifically. But checks and balances, there's no such thing when you've got unfalsifiable claims. You can't check a claim that can't be falsified.
But this is where unfalsifiable claims are made. But then let's just say the party wants to defend themselves. And we spoke about this before, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
You're not expecting a non-molestation order. You have a process server turn up, for example. You know, you're in shock, you're in awe, you know, you're opposed with something you didn't think you'd ever have. How do people go down the route of fighting these if they are part of this 25%?
Well, yeah, and that's the issue, right? So yeah. So I think Jerry's blatantly wrong. You can't have a check and balance on an unfalsifiable claim. It logically can't happen.
Yeah.
But no, I agree with you. Where there are these 25% of malicious claims, those people should be buried under the prison too.
They should,
because you just should not be allowed to treat another human being that indecently. Not when it comes with consequences. And we spoke earlier about the fact that with non-molestation orders, there are consequences. There can be periods of time in prison. A person's civil freedoms can be taken off them.
Yeah.
And they can be housed at His Majesty's pleasure.
Yeah, five years imprisonment, Matt.
5 years?
For
breaking a non-molestation order that you didn't deserve. And this is why, folks, this is the message we're trying to convey here just now, really, is if you are served with a non-molestation order, there is no single better advice you can receive than get a solicitor, and if you can't do that, get a Mackenzie friend.
Yes.
Because you need to represent in court. You absolutely cannot afford to lose your temper at that point.
Yeah.
At all. You just need to go and represent and give, essentially, your best argument for why that claim is false.
Now, to be clear, and this should not need repeating, we at DAD support injunctions that protect women, men, non-binary others and children from abuse. They are a good thing when they are applied appropriately.
Absolutely. Likewise, though, we have a passion for addressing miscarriages of justice. And where these orders are abused, a complete mockery is made of the family court process. The misapplication of these orders is not protecting people. It's ruining lives. And most importantly, disrupting the potential stability of our children. As a society, we should be appalled by this. There is almost no other court injunction where the bar for evidence is so low. Accepted, if a non-molestation is served to you, you have the opportunity to defend against it in a finding of fact hearing. But, as we were saying in last week's episode, this comes at considerable personal cost.
So, obviously, when we're talking about costs, what do we do or what do people do if they can't afford these costs?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and we've kind of spoke about this a lot. We've pondered this. Every time we've done an episode, we've ended up on the phone talking about what about that group of individuals who can't afford legal support. Mackenzie Friend is probably the best option.
Yes.
Although professional Mackenzie Friends come at a cost as well. But I think there's anybody, remember, can be a Mackenzie friend. So I'd be find your smartest friend,
yeah,
or somebody in you can access in your friendship group and ask them to come along with you. For me, it would just be about representing my story, my truth as clearly as I could.
So in 2018, Lindsay Perryman, a principal associate at Wayman Solicitors, suggested that it would be unfair to suggest the majority of applicants for non-moles are exploiting the system. She suggests that in her law firm's experience, some parents are taking advantage of this process because they are unable to pay legal fees to fund family legal disputes. She goes on to suggest that responsibility for this rests with the government due to the sweeping reforms introduced through LASPO with the abuse of the non-mol system. To quote Lindsay, an unfortunate byproduct of failed reforms.
So Court Help Limited offer a range of support services for people seeking legal advice and support. They recognise that up to 25% of non-molestation orders are made without proper consideration of evidence apart from witness statements. Statements which, they claim, may not be true. If you haven't heard it already, please go back and have a listen to our podcast episode on the truth. This was episode 3, I think, and helps us understand how this term is used legally. Yeah, so I think the importance there is just that a claim isn't the same as the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth is something that has a burden of proof, and the stuff you use to demonstrate that burden is evidence.
But again, we've spoke about the burden of proof. It's not your burden to obviously provide your...
Yeah, for your innocence.
Yeah, if you're innocent, you've got to be proven guilty.
Yeah, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt.
And so let's have a chat of the 25% of people who are falsely accused of abuse through the weaponisation of the non-molestation system. If you are accused of abuse and have absolutely not done this, you have to carry yourself in a particular way. Follow this short guide to help you better understand how to manage this. If a non-mol is filed against you, you will be served by a process server. These orders are often filed for domestic abuse, and even if you have done nothing, do not lose your temper. Process servers wear body-worn cameras will tell you they are recording, and so your behaviour should be exemplary. This refutes the claim levelled against you.
The second step is to seek legal support. This can be either a solicitor or a McKenzie friend. Don't go it alone. Self-representation in a hearing that has such sweeping implications for you, your welfare and your children demands some sort of representation.
The third step follows some advice offered last week. You will be going to court, so dress appropriately. Looking the part helps the court recognise your sincerity.
You may hear some things in court that are blatantly untrue, and if you're anything like us, social justice warriors with a keen eye for the truth and justice, you may react in a negative way. Giving in to your primordial self and letting that inner caveman come up and losing your ship all over the place will not aid you. Keep a level head and convey your version of events as clearly, concisely and effectively as you can.
And finally, forget your reputation and the ego bruises that might appear because of the blatant lies. Remember why you are standing there in court. You are there to fight for your good name and most importantly for your children. If you are accused of doing something you did not do, let the world know what the truth is. The lack of transparency and press access to family courts mean there is literally nobody else in the world but you who can promote this idea. No other human being has the right or authority and the need to label you as something you are not. I am reminded of Article 5 of the Human Rights Act 2000, and I quote, "Everyone has the right to liberty and security. No one shall be deprived of his or her liberty, save in accordance with procedures prescribed by law." The serving of a weaponized non-molestation order is a direct threat to your liberties and freedoms. If you won't fight your battles, who will?
And that would seem to be a logical place to end, buddy.
Sounds good to me.
This one was hard work.
It was.
Hopefully there's stuff in there that helps.
Yeah, I mean, you can say that again, but listen, folks, as we said last week, we're here to give you a place of support and encouragement. If you are a dad actively involved in your children's lives, or you are trying to be, and you are not a deadbeat, this is most definitely the place for you.
Oh, while I think about it, we have a couple of exciting updates. Firstly, Lee will be in the shed this weekend with the green screen and the camera as we begin to record our vodcast series. Lee has an exciting, heartbreaking, emotional and cognitively challenging story to tell. And so we hope you will join us for that in the near future.
In addition, me and the big man are now officially signed up to our divorce coaching and McKenzie Friends course, and hope to qualify in the next 12 months. Some of us are smarter than others, as we know, so 12 months should be sufficient enough.
I wouldn't say I was that dumb.
Well, that's what I was trying to suggest. But so we are blogging our journey through this learning experience, and to tell you more about how we intend to offer the service to the people in the future.
And so, Mr. Lee, what's your thought for the day?
My thought for the day today is, a false accusation can crumble the ground beneath your feet, but integrity and observance of the golden rule is what keeps you standing.
Beautiful as always, that man. Right, dad joke time. What's the best way to catch a fish?
With a fishing rod?
No, have someone throw it at you.
That's called a wet fish. a slap in the face.
All of these jokes are wet fish jokes. So thank you once again for joining us in the shed, folks. We hope this episode has been informative and helped somebody out there. Please remember to like, share and subscribe. Hey Lee, we've got 7 followers now on Podbean. It really does help us out. And let's end in the usual way with the dad creed. Come on folks, join in if you know the words.
In those moments when you feel downcast, when the hope is sucked from your lungs and your gaze is cast to the floor in despair, raise your head up high, and with the thought of the most precious thing in your life, your children, held firmly in your heart, say the DAD creed with me. I believe in nothing more than the love I have for you, not hell nor high water, not rain nor shine, not hate nor despair, or those who would keep us apart with no true cause to do so, will change this love. A father's love is like no other, imparted on his soul from the moment he first saw the apple of his eye. The rights of fathers and those of their children are not a privilege, they are a right. A right we will exercise with compassion, care, love and observance of the golden rule. Raise your hands confidently, caringly and with hope. Be counted, because not all dads are deadbeats.
And so, if you're interested in having riveting conversations about fathers, their children, rights and agency, look out for DAD on the interwebs and social media. We look forward to seeing you and welcoming you to our conversations.